Welcome to the Capital Connection, a weekly program questioning New York State leaders on a variety of issues. Your host is Dr. Alan Chartok, political scientist and professor emeritus at the University at Albany. Distribution for the Capital Connection is made possible with the help of New York State United Teachers, representing professionals in education and healthcare, online at nysut.org.
It's the Capital Connection. Hi, I'm Alan Chartok. On the program this week is Jimmy Vielkind, Albany Bureau Chief for Politico. Welcome back, Jimmy. It's always great to have you here.
Happy New Year. Happy to be here.
Okay, let me start first with something that seems highly symbolic. It may not be the most important thing we're confronting, but it is interesting to me. And that is, there seems to be a move, both in the United States Congress, but here in Albany, to restrict the way in which people can use their cell phones in the state Senate.
Well, you're bringing up a kind of a fascinating subplot of what happened this week, which is that the legislature, the 63 members of the state Senate and the 150 members of the state assembly, returned to the Capitol to begin their 2017 session. And, you know, normally that's a basic day. The leaders of each house lay out their priorities. We heard Republicans, who will once again control the Senate, and I think we'll probably get into that a little bit later, talk about jobs and their desire to be an independent, co-equal branch of government. We heard Democrats, who dominate the state assembly, talk about their desire to increase spending on social programs, including education, housing, protecting affordable health care, and planning to raise taxes to do it, and also at the same time making strong stances in favor of abortion rights and criminal justice reform, including a measure that would increase the age of criminal responsibility. But then on that day, as a subplot and sort of a surprise subplot, the Republicans, who control the state Senate, offered a set of rules that codified restrictions on the use of cell phones. Now, I've been covering the state Senate since 2009, so this is my eighth year being a reporter at the Capitol, and there have always been some restrictions, and frankly, things are a little stodgy. Gentlemen need to have coats and ties on to go to the floor. You're not allowed to take pictures on the floor of the chamber unless you're one of the official photographers. These are the rules. And it's you know, for a younger generation, you can look at some of these things and think, like, why? There's no purpose to this. But I understand the idea of institution wanting to set rules of decorum. But what was announced on Wednesday, as senators were arriving for their first session of the year, were formal restrictions on the use of cell phones, not just on the chamber floor, but also in the visitor galleries up above, where regular New Yorkers are invited and able to watch their government in action, and also the lobby outside, where senators are sometimes available for informal conversations with both constituents, members of the media, and of course, the people for whom the room is named, the lobbyists. And it's unclear how this is going to apply. It's not perfectly clear to me whether this is a big tempest in a teapot, but it's certainly not something to be happy about, I think, in any way. The new rules would restrict the taking of pictures or videos or apparently audio recordings with cell phones. There's nothing in the rules that would prevent you from using a tape recorder or a camera to take pictures or video recordings. So I don't quite know what the practical effect of this is going to be. I don't quite know yet how vigorously this is going to be enforced, but it certainly is a twisting and, again, not a happy nothing that I'm happy about to start the year. And as you said, Alan, it reflects, I don't want to say a push, it certainly reflects a mood and in some instances a pattern of government knocking back the freedom of the press at a time when I think it should be doing exactly the opposite, pushing for more transparency, pushing for more access. And especially as we enter interesting political and governmental times in this country, I think it should be easier for people to connect, see, touch, and feel their government rather than harder.
You know, Jimmy Vielkind, I think this started in the House of Representatives when John Lewis led a group of people to the well of the House to protest governmental policy and sat there, and they didn't like it because it appeared all over the country that these guys were doing this. Here's Lewis, the symbolic guy who had his head beaten in at Selma, Alabama, and all the rest of it, leading this group out of total frustration, said, we're never putting that on again. And they have cameras, of course, but those cameras are directed by the house itself. So here, you're going to see the same thing. But of course, there are spy cameras. People can put stuff in their lapel now the size of a pea and can take pictures. So as you say, it's unclear how that could be enforced.
That's right. And, you know, professional newspaper photographers would often go to the gallery and shoot members of the Senate as they make laws and debate laws. And it's not hard sometimes to find senators who are asleep on the floor. It's also quite common to see people, including sitting senators, in the process of debating laws on their phone, answering emails. I don't know what they're doing, texting their friends, etc. So, you know, again, I don't think this is good, but I'm not convinced that this is a terrible frontal assault, because many of these rules were in place either informally or less formally than they may be in place now. So of course, we should note that Democrats in the chamber stood up. They made a big deal out of this. They said it was an attack on the free press, and they loudly objected to these rules before they were summarily voted down.
Jimmy, do you have a lot of ties? Because you have to walk on the floor, too, all the time. And you have a jacket and tie.
Well, you know, I've tried to wear fewer ties in my life in the last few years, but I do keep a few in the office to make sure I can get on. Whether or not they match is not one of the criteria.
So that leads us to the whole question of the organization of the state Senate, Jimmy Vilkind. And that is, it now appears that everybody has their way. Because a lot of us have been thinking for a long time, hey, Andrew Cuomo, you're not fooling anybody. You want a Republican state Senate. The Republicans want a Republican state Senate. The Independent Conference of Democrats wants a Republican state Senate, because that way they get their whatever little things they get as a result for combining with the Republicans. And so it's not surprising that even though there are more Democrats than Republicans, we got a Republican state Senate.
Yeah. So it was a Republican year nationwide, of course. And the expectation was not that in New York. The expectation was that finally the Democrats, who had a numerical 32 seats in the Senate going into this election, would win a few and be able to pick up that chamber's majority for the second time really since the 1960s. Of course, the first time being 2009 and 2010, when the first election of Barack Obama propelled them into the chamber's majority. But let me just do some quick math for listeners who might care. The chamber has 31 Republicans. It has one.
Let me just interrupt for 1 second and tell you that I was here during Goldwater, and the Democrats briefly, 1 year, had the majority.
That's right. There are now 31 Republicans in the state Senate. They sit with a Democrat from Brooklyn whose name is Simca Felder. He's conservative. He ran on the Republican and the Democratic lines.
This time, but has always run as a Democrat.
He has always run as a Democrat, but he's often also run on the Republican line.
Right.
But he, you know, he's considered to be a Democrat, and he has been very clear about saying he will go with whomever is best for his constituents, which means whoever has the power. And so since he was elected to the Senate for the first time in, I believe, 2014, he has sat with the Republicans. So that's 32. That's the ballgame. Now, on top of that, you have this IDC, the Independent Democratic Conference, that you and I have talked about and that I assume some of your listeners are quite familiar with. It's now grown to 7 members. There was a senator from Brooklyn, Jesse Hamilton, a mainstream Democrat. He defected from that conference and joined the IDC. And in a primary that opened up when Adriano Espaillat, a state senator, won a seat in Congress, the IDC backed a woman named Marisol Alcantara, and she emerged from a 3-way primary as a victor, and she too has joined the IDC. So what we've heard is a variation of the fighting that we've heard for about the last 5 years from factions within the Democratic Party that the IDC should rejoin its brothers and sisters in the mainstream Democratic Conference, that together they would be a united force. And this year that was particularly important because of the election of Donald Trump. The IDC argues, and many institutions, including some major labor unions, the Reverend Al Sharpton, have given them comfort in this argument that they're able to push progressive Democratic policies while working with the Republicans. And I think Andrew Cuomo is of this mind as well. He hasn't said as much directly, but he tried to say very little about this debate, despite the attempts and the calls by some that he get involved and kind of force a marriage between the Democratic diaspora that exists within the chamber. So I do think, as you said, Alan, Cuomo is a winner in this. It's no secret that he's worked quite wonderfully with Republicans in control of the state Senate, having Jeff Klein as sort of a buffer, because Klein's politics and the politics of the IDC, I think, mesh pretty well with Cuomo's own politics and his social liberalism, his fiscal more or less conservatism, people argue, his sensibilities. I think they mesh very well with the IDC. So I think Cuomo is very, very content with this arrangement of the state Senate, and mostly because I don't think Cuomo wanted to see a state Senate that was dominated by just the mainstream Democrats and their leader, Andrea Stewart Cousins of Yonkers. They campaigned on, and they were expected to push, if they were in the majority, a much more liberal agenda than perhaps Cuomo wanted to push, particularly on fiscal issues. We have a big debate coming in this state over whether or not to renew in whole or in part, or even extend, a millionaire's tax, which is set to expire at the end of the year. And facing two houses of the legislature that would have been in strong favor of extending that would have perhaps boxed Cuomo into a place that he didn't want to be. Now, that said, he did, in 2016, campaign more vigorously for his fellow Democrats than ever before. And, you know, it is a little ridiculous to think that a Democratic governor would do anything but campaign quite vigorously for his own party mates to take control of the legislature. But that has not been the case with Cuomo, in part for the reasons I just explained.
But I've talked to people, Jimmy Vielkind, who are in and around the Senate and who have made it quite clear they think Cuomo... they think he's a phony. They don't think he really campaigned the way he should. He picked out a couple of symbolic places and went there, but he didn't really, really push for a Democratic state Senate.
Yeah, there are certainly people who believe he could have done more and who say he could have done more. And I think objectively, yes, he could have done more. He did more than he's ever done. He did help raise money for the conference's efforts, and I believe that was rather vigorous. And as Senate Democrats said, because of course this has been a Cold War for years, as they said during the election cycle, before the election, that Cuomo did everything that they asked him to do. So could he have done more? Yes. Did he actually want them to win? You know, I don't know. Maybe deep in his heart of hearts, I think that he was making a pragmatic play. I think he expected and misread, as many people, myself included, he thought it was going to be a big Democratic year in New York. He misread that it was, in fact, a Republican year here in New York. And I think that that bet pushed him closer to his party mates than he had previously come.
So, Jimmy Vielkind, this gets us very close to the histrionic and historic fight between the governor and the legislature. What's going on?
That's right. So things are sour. It's going to be a very, very interesting legislative session because for the now entering his seventh year in office, Cuomo is confronting cantankerous, angry, and frankly just sour members of both the Democrat-dominated Assembly and the Republican-controlled Senate than really at any other point in his tenure. And so why are the legislators angry? First and foremost, they didn't get a pay raise.
Sure.
There was the expectation in 2016 that an independent panel would recommend for legislators the first increase in their $79,500 base pay since 1998. That didn't happen. This commission was set up. It first dealt with court judges and the judiciary, and I don't think anyone really complained when it looked at data and recommended a salary increase, and it was perceived as a fairly nonpartisan, data-driven, ministerial almost thing. And the expectation was that the same thing would happen to legislators. Now, that panel, in the days just after the election, did not recommend a pay increase for legislators. And it was Governor Cuomo's appointees to the panel who led it toward adjournment without making that recommendation.
They got the word. We all assume that the panel got the word from the governor.
Exactly.
Don't give him a pay raise.
We all assume. This supposedly independent panel, and I should say that rolling my eyes, maybe listeners can hear it over the air here, because other panels that have been supposedly independent that were created by Governor Cuomo have a long history of not being anything close to independent. And really,
ethics groups and other people like that.
The Moreland Commission, let us not revisit. But there is this established pattern here, and legislators, of course, perceive that this is exactly the governor's doing.
So how does it play out?
What he tried to do with that was set up a special session. The governor was willing to assent to a legislative pay hike.
Sure.
And by the way, let's not lose sight of the fact that it would have raised his own pay as well and those of his commissioners in state government. But I don't know the extent to which that pulls at his heartstrings. In exchange for a series of measures, some of which would have been government reform and restructuring. Now, we all know that Governor Cuomo is right now grappling with federal indictments of members of his inner circle. Yes. This is dragging him down. He was supposed to be the white knight who came in to clean up Albany, and instead he's heading toward a federal trial of a man who was his closest political aide, Joe Prococo, and who he likened to a brother. So his
to say
surrogate,
nothing about his other friend Todd Howe or Elaine Kelly-Eros.
Yes, jinx. And so yes, there are corruption problems in the administration itself,
and he has to face a potential primary when he's running for governor the next time. And there is, you know, I mean, Zephyr Teachout almost cleaned his clock the last time, and he's got to do some lefty stuff that will pacify his audience. He's got anybody under $125,000 goes to college. He's got the minimum wage, and he's got several other things that he's been doing lately. The question is, will it help?
Well, that in a minute. I think more immediately, he needed to pass some reform measures so that he could look at the public and say, look, I've passed some reform measures. My surrogate brother is about to start his federal trial, but luckily we did X, Y, Z, A, B, C, T, U, V to shore up our shop here in the state government. That didn't happen. And so the effect of that is that this whole overarching call for reform, I expect, is going to bleed into the coming legislative session in the coming year. Cuomo knew that. He wanted to get it done and over with before the new year came, but it fell apart essentially when the Republicans in the state Senate couldn't muster the votes to come back for a special session. That was particularly acute in that the leader, John Flanagan, a Republican from Long Island, seemed ready and eager to make this deal. And I think there were some members of the conference who were ready to make a deal. But there were other members, mostly from upstate areas, where $79,500 a year for a part-time job is a very fine salary and very difficult to complain about to your constituents.
And most of them are getting $79,000. Most of them
are getting
a lot more because they're getting Lulus and, you know, things of that kind. And by the way, the people don't really want to give them a pay raise.
Right. That's right. And so the session blew up, and here we are with sour lawmakers in January. The other thing the governor did was he decided to eliminate the State of the State speech, which would have traditionally been held this week in Albany at the state capitol or in the capitol complex. That is not going to happen. In the week of January 9th, Governor Cuomo is going to be doing 6 events around the state, and legislators see it as a sign of disrespect. They see it as a public relations.
Well, it is a sign of disrespect, isn't it?
Yeah. All of which, as you said, is coming up to a sour year with legislators, and the more fascinating issues of what's Cuomo going to do and where is he going to position himself politically?
Well, everybody's still mentioning his name for running for president of the United States. Of course, if he gets up at a trial and all of a sudden his name gets bandied about by the people who are on trial, it could hurt him the way it hurt Chris Christie, who now has, I think, the lowest approval rating in history in his state. So it's an iffy thing, the presidential thing especially right now.
Well, that's right. So Governor Cuomo has said he's going to seek a third term in 2018.
You know anybody who can run against him?
Well, I think you could, Alan.
Yeah. But other than me, and by the way, that's a joke, folks. I live in Massachusetts. Is there anybody that you see who could present a real danger to this governor?
Everyone I talk to expects that he will have a primary on the left, that there will be a left flank challenger, as you just said, Alan. As to who it's going to be, we don't know. Eric Schneiderman, I don't believe Comptroller Tom DiNapoli is going to launch a primary. I think if Governor Cuomo opts not to seek a third term, that we have to consider both of those guys into the mix. But right now, there's no Democrat of a very strong stature who's thinking of it. I think perhaps the highest profile person who might do a run, even if the governor did it, is Stephanie Miner, the mayor of Syracuse. She's going to be term limited from her office at the end of 2017.
Well, she's terrific, but whether she can carry New York and the burbs, I mean, clearly she could carry upstate New York, but whether she could carry New York City and Long Island, that's where Cuomo prevailed over Zephyr Teachout. So
I think that Governor Cuomo is really, as you said, Alan, still scarred from the run that Zephyr Teachout gave him in 2014, where she drew a little bit more than a third of the vote. And in upstate areas, she won
she
many upstate
them.
Carries.
Yes.
Right, including, I believe she won Albany County.
Yes, she did.
And so Cuomo has since then taken care to shore up his left flank. A few minutes ago, I described him as someone who was socially liberal and basically an economic conservative. I think he realized through 2014 and through watching Bernie Sanders ignite the base of his party that you can't do that as a Democrat. You have to do more than pay lip service to economic populism, because that's where the base of the party is. And frankly, that's where the American people are. They're demanding action. So this year, Governor Cuomo is, as you already said, Alan, he's proposed an extension of tuition subsidies to have, quote,
right,
free tuition in public colleges. We're still waiting to hear what the rest of his agenda is going to be. But as you also said, a lot of it's going to be infrastructure building, which
LaGuardia,
everybody loves.
LaGuardia, Kennedy, you name it.
Well, he would
that.
Say LaGuardia, but as a Bronx boy, you could probably do this. You
no,
do
I'm
it
a Manhattan
than,
boy.
Well, as a Manhattan boy, you could do it better than this upstater can.
Okay, but Jimmy, I want to get to another subject. We only got a couple of minutes left, and that is the clemency that he's offered to Judith Clark. And I'm wondering whether this could become, you know, his Willie Horton.
It's an interesting calculation. The Judith Clark clemency, and for people who don't know, Judith Clark was the getaway driver in the 1981 Brinks heist, in which leftist militants, I believe there were some moments of the Black Panthers, Ms. Clark, I think, was a member of the Weather Underground, hijacked an armored car for a lot of money to fuel their revolutionary activities. And in the process of that, one driver was killed and two Rockland County police officers were killed.
Mm-hmm.
Now, Judith Clark didn't pull the trigger. She was the getaway driver, but under our criminal justice, she was involved in a scheme, murder committed, so she, by the felony murder rule, was implicated in that. She did not take a plea deal, and she was sentenced to 75 years to life with the possibility of parole only coming after 75 years of her sentence. Other people who were involved in that heist have been paroled. They've left prison. She is not. And there are criminal justice advocates, lawyers, people who look at this, including, I think, past presidents of the New York City Bar Association,
sure,
who have argued for her case, and they've clearly argued to the governor. He met with her at the Bedford Hills facility in Westchester County, where she has been incarcerated.
And where he's basically a neighbor.
That's right. He didn't go very far. And he said he was impressed by her and gave her the chance. But more broadly, Judith Clark's chance for parole and the partial commutation of her sentence was not what the Cuomo administration was hoping to focus when it was announced the last days of 2016. They also announced that 101 people were granted conditional pardons. And these were 16 and 17-year-olds who had been convicted as a result of a little quirk in New York law, where we are one of two states that treats 16 and 17-year-olds not as juveniles, but as adults. Therefore, they're tried in adult courts. They're not tried in family courts. And if you are convicted as a 16-year-old of robbery, if you stole a credit card, for example, that's a felony, you will have a permanent lifetime criminal record. Now, this is also the subject of a big push by criminal justice advocates. It's called Raise the Age. The Republicans who control the state Senate, they don't like it one bit. So what will Cuomo do? He's positioning himself for 2020. Is he going to expend a lot of political capital on this, or is he going to build things to help the building trades?
I don't think he meant to, but on Judith Clark, the son of one of the murdered people said, "My father's not coming back." And that's a powerful argument.
It's a powerful argument. It's an argument I don't think Cuomo anticipated he would have to have, but that he'll do. But I think this was more of a stiff arm to people who are looking for criminal justice reforms that he knows he's not going to be able to get legislatively.
Well, you know what's going to happen? There's going to come that point when Judith Clark has to now appear before the parole or clemency board.
The parole board, yes.
And my bet is that there's going to be a wink and a nod, and they're going to say no.
Well, it's possible. The governor has not said clearly whether or not he will weigh in on her behalf, and he has sort of tempered his remarks to say that he believes she should have the chance to make her case.
There you go. We always love talking to Jimmy Wielkheim. We haven't gotten to so much, Jimmy. The next time we'll talk about Carl Palladino and his racist rants and some other things. Anyway, we thank Jimmy Wielkheim, Albany Bureau Chief for Politico. Jimmy, again, thanks for joining us this week, and we hope to have you back again soon.
Thanks, Alan. Always a pleasure to be with you and your listeners.
The Capital Connection is distributed with the cooperation of the public radio stations of New York State. David Gustina is the producer of The Capital Connection, a production of WAMC Northeast Public Radio in Albany. Support for The Capital Connection comes from New York State United Teachers, representing professionals in education and healthcare, online at nysut.org.